Welcome to All Souls Forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, our guest Dave Helling, member of the Kansas City Star editorial board and well-known political columnist, shares his thoughts as we head into the midterm elections. Although this forum will run after the elections, this show is worth listening to because Helling does not predict the election outcome, but rather focuses on the context of the elections, regardless of the final outcome. This show is recorded on November 4th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. My name is George Baggett. I'm a member of the All Souls Forum Committee. The forum's mission is to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues. This morning's topic reminds me of the story. Let me put it differently. The issue in front of us, we need one more phone call from somebody telling us who to vote for or how to vote. But I tell you what, we have an incredible privilege of having Dave Helling here this morning, who is on the editorial board of the Kansas City Star, and most of you already know who he is, so I shouldn't spend much time introducing himself, except he's a wonderful friend, and I think you're going to be thrilled with what he has to say for you to you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, George, and welcome, and it's great to see everyone here on kind of a crummy Sunday, before Election Day. I think you'd agree with me that the fall colors have been spectacular this year, amazing. And I was mentioning to someone the other day, it's a shame we have to spoil it with an election. But on the other hand, maybe it's a reminder that even in times of difficulty, beauty still is a part of our lives. And maybe that's the best way to think about it. I'm going to talk to you. It's great to be here, great to see friends and old faces that I've known for many years in Kansas City. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think may happen on Tuesday. And then I want to make some broader points, if I can, about the state of our politics and our government and our media. And then, of course, obviously take questions from the audience if you have any. I had a chance to have some coffee this morning before my visit here, and an older gentleman came up to me while I was drinking coffee and said, "Are you Dave Helling?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Oh, I read your column all the time." I said, "Well, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I appreciate you reading the paper." And he said, "And you're very fair to President Trump. I like that." And I thought, "Uh-oh." Maybe my writing isn't as clear sometimes as I would like it to be, but I hope that at the end of our conversation you will agree that I've tried to be fair, or at least to observe what is happening in our world in a multi-partisan way. I also will avoid making real specific predictions of the outcomes. On Tuesday, 2 years ago, in the old room, the old newsroom at the Star, Steve Kraske, I think you probably know Steve, and I sat right across, facing each other across a little divide. And as you may recall, the New York Times had a needle, the famous needle that bounced that day, giving probabilities of the presidential outcome. And it started at about 90% chance that Hillary Clinton would be elected president, and it kept moving over. And finally, after about 2 hours, I said to Steve, I said, "I think Trump might win this thing." And he goes, "You're crazy. That'll never happen." And it was a reminder for both of us that predicting outcomes for elections is a very dangerous thing. Polls are not as accurate as we would like. We don't get a chance to talk with everyone, so I'll do my best to stay away from specific predictions, but I do want to talk a little bit about what I think are trends. So thank you for your patience, and again, thanks for coming today. Let me start by saying that I think on Wednesday morning, first of all, we're not going to settle anything Wednesday morning. I think we're going to wake up and the verdict of the voters will be muddled, both about the president, the Congress, state races as well. But I do think we can say that if trends hold, we will wake up Wednesday and Missouri will be more conservative than Kansas. Now think about that for a minute. Think about that for a minute. Back in 2012, Steve Kraske and I wrote a story for the Star about the Kansas congressional delegation, and we wrote with some evidence that it was the most conservative in America. And you think back to the House members then, I wrote them down, Tim Huel's camp, who was, you know, one of the original Tea Party people, Kevin Yoder, of course, Lynn Jenkins, and Mike Pompeo is now the Secretary of State in the Trump administration, all members of Congress from Kansas in 2012, and their voting records certainly suggested that they were the most conservative delegation in the United States. Oklahoma and South Carolina gave us a run for our money, but Kansas was conservative in that way. And then, of course, two Republican senators. Sam Brownback was governor. 2012 was the year that the infamous tax cuts were passed. They took effect in 2013. So 6 years ago, not very long ago, Kansas was just as bad of conservative politically as you can imagine. And at the same time, in Missouri, Governor Jay Nixon, who was a Democrat, of course, Claire McCaskill. In the early 2010s, you had four members of Congress who were Democrats from Missouri, Emanuel Cleaver and Lacey Clay, of course, but Ike Skelton, who was in the 4th District in the early 2010s, and then Russ Carnahan, who was a member of Congress from the St. Louis area. His district was eliminated in redistricting. But you had, and then, of course, Claire McCaskill was the senator, so there was a sense that Democrats at least could be competitive, conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat in that time frame. Todd Akin had just been defeated in 2012, as you'll recall. So 6 years ago, Kansas was much more conservative than Missouri. Wednesday, I think, we're going to see that flip in some ways. It's a distinct possibility that two of the four members of the House from Kansas will be Democrats, Sharice Davids and Paul Davis. I think Kris Kobach, who was the Secretary of State 6 years ago, is in trouble in his race for the governorship in Kansas to Laura Kelly. And at the same time, I do think that Claire McCaskill may be in some trouble in Missouri, which reflects the changeover of the two states perhaps as well as anything else. Rural areas in Missouri, as much as anywhere else, are undergoing a values-based transition to a more conservative approach. And I think that's clear from the results of presidential elections. If you'll recall, in 2008, Barack Obama, in essence, tied John McCain in Missouri. In 2012, he lost. Obama lost Missouri by 10 points. And in 2016, Missouri went for Donald Trump by 19 points. So the shift from a sort of 50-50 state to a more conservative state seems very clear. But I would argue that this switch looks weird to us, but it isn't really, because historically, Kansas has been a bit more moderate than Missouri. It's just disguised by the fact that moderation in politics 50, 60 years ago was a Democratic thing. You had a solid Democratic South. Much of that a reflection perhaps of the remainder or the feelings about the Civil War, but guys like Ike Skelton could be elected in Missouri as a conservative Democrat. Those days are almost gone, not because people have changed their views, but because Republicans are now what Democrats were. And that's why Republicans carry the Deep South now. How many in this room ever thought they would see Republicans win in Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama? When I was growing up, I'll be 64 in May, that was inconceivable. And so that flip has happened, and it's happened in Missouri. That has moved Missouri to the right. And at the same time, Kansas is bouncing back a little bit from its rightward swing to a more moderate Republicanism, exemplified by Nancy Kassebaum, who was my favorite politician that I've ever covered in 40 years, or Bill Graves, or Mike Hayden. Kansas has a moderate Republican history that was changed only by this, what I think is aberrational move to the sharp right in 2005 to roughly 2015. So that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing is both states, in my view, reverting to much of their political history, with Missouri being to the right of Kansas. It's just that party identification is changing, and we'll see how that turns out. Now, again, it could be that Kansas will elect Chris Kobach and will send Steve Watkins to Congress, and I'll be back next Sunday to revise and extend my remarks. But that's what I think is going to happen, that we're in essence reverting to the mean of our politics in the two states. Now, that's as much as I want to talk about what I think is going to happen in the races. I'll certainly, if you want to talk about the ballot issues and other things in Missouri, I'll be happy to do so, other races. But I want to make a broader point that I hope this audience will appreciate, and that is I want to talk about truth and the role of truth in our politics and the role of facts in our politics. You know, we've been told that this is the most important election of our lifetimes, and I must say, it seems like we're told that every 2 years, aren't we? And that 2 years from now, oh, that 2018, nobody cared, this is the most important election. The fact of the matter is that all elections are important. All choices are important. No election is more important than another, other than what they tell us about where we are as a country and as a society. The people that we send to office come and go. I mentioned to you the four members of Congress from Kansas. If Kevin Yoder loses Tuesday, all four will be gone. All four will be gone. Politicians, elected officials, and I must say reporters and pundits come and go. But elections are a good way to take the temperature of our country and to understand things about our country. And what we need to do to develop, as the founder said, a more perfect union. And I believe, and I hope this doesn't sound like hyperbole, but I believe we are in a moment where really the fate of the American experiment will be decided in the next 10 to 20 years. And in that sense, this election is extraordinarily important. I just started reading a book, a new book by Jill Lepore, who's a historian called These Truths. It's a history of the United States, and it's about truth and the importance of truth, self-evident truths, but other truths, in understanding how we can work together as a community. Now, we can disagree and have disagreed violently over the years about different approaches to problems and different political views and how things can be fixed or not fixed or what needs to be addressing. But we have always believed in facts and in truth as the first stop on that journey to understanding and discussion. I used to do a thing called Truth Watch on television, which now seems rather arrogant to me that we called it that. But the idea was that truth and facts are fundamental to our discussions in a democracy. They are absolutely critical to understanding, in my view, where we are and how we reach decisions. You know, we can argue, and we do all the time about things. When we're done, let's talk about the airport. Should we have built a new airport or should we have not built it? That's a legitimate discussion. But no one in this room is going to say, I don't know what an airport is, or I don't think people really can fly. I mean, that's kind of a basic thing, is we have to understand facts before we can have opinions. Otherwise, the democratic experiment is under enormous stress. We won't get very far if we disagree over what an airport is or what the state of our economy is or other important facts about our country and our community. And I must say, and I think this is why we're in such difficult times, facts are under assault as never before in my time as a reporter, which is about four decades. And particularly that's true, I must say, of the president and President Trump. I wrote the editorial today that endorsed Sharice Davids in the district, in the 3rd District of Kansas. And one of the things I wrote was the president actually has a pretty good economic story to tell, but he has no interest in telling that at all. He has, according to at least one fact-checking organization, he has lied or misled people 6,000 times in 2 years. Last week, one day last week, he said 30 things that were not true or misleading. That, for example, last week he said that 97% of the immigrants who come to this country and are apprehended at the border and then released pending a court date, 97%, he said, never show up for their court appearance. The correct figure, of course, is 28%. And so that's just one example of a grossly wrong statement the president made to try and make a point. Now, a lot of people have said to me, everybody knows he exaggerates. Everybody knows the president says things that aren't true for political effect. He knows they're not true. You know they're not true. Right after the inauguration, when he claimed that the crowd size was bigger than President Obama's, or that he claimed, when he claimed he actually won the popular vote shortly after Election Day. A lot of people said, that's just him being a TV show guy. It's trivial. Don't worry about it. Don't pay attention to it. And I think that is absolutely the wrong approach to take, absolutely the wrong political and democratic thing, small-d democratic thing to do. Because it isn't about the lies and it isn't about the facts that can be straightened out by newspapers or other journalism organizations or opponents. It's more fundamental than that. You know, even the president's supporters understand that he tells untruths, but they accept that as part of him. And I would suggest that lies from the president are never acceptable, never. Now, that doesn't mean you won't get the usual exaggerations and spin. I get that. But to make factual statements that are easily correctable based on the record it really distorts our democracy and causes what I believe to be serious disconnects between the people and their politicians. Because if you can lie with impunity, as the president does, then you can cheat. And if you can cheat, you can steal. And if you can steal, you can commit other crimes. And maybe you can fire a weapon in a church with people of a different color or a different faith. The idea that lying is acceptable in absolute lying in a political context is acceptable is abhorrent and leads to, at least indirectly in my view, a dissonant, violent, difficult politics defines the era that we are in today. Thank you. And that's why I have written repeatedly, and apparently my friend at the coffee shop hasn't read this, that the president's problems is that he is breaking democratic norms, small-d democratic norms. That is, the idea that if we are to have fruitful discussions and disagreements, they must be based on the truth and not the world as you would want it to be or that you think your followers would want it to be. Now, how does this happen? How does the president do these things? Well, part of it is the decline of your local newspaper. Now, when I talk about things like this, everybody immediately assumes it's an elaborate pitch to get people to subscribe to the Star. And the reality is, yes, that's exactly what it is. And as I've said before, after my talk today, I'd be happy to take your subscription in the back of the room for those who don't subscribe digitally or on paper. But the reality is that the journalistic endeavor in our country, which has been a part of our history since its beginning, is under threat as never before. Now, you know, the president likes to call us, you know, call mainstream reporting fake news, and a lot of my colleagues get upset at that term and don't like it. It doesn't bother me as much, primarily because I, you know, political reporters get yelled at all the time. I've spent 40 years being criticized. Today, after the David's editorial ran, just read my Twitter feed, and I'm called all kinds of things. And so, I think people know when they hear fake news that the president is really describing news he doesn't like. So the threat to us is not external. It's not criticism. I tell people all the time say to me, well, who elected you? And I say, the reality is you elect me every day when you open your paper or click on one of my stories online or listen to me here. That's how I face the public. And if I don't do what the public wants, then my value diminishes. So fake news isn't a problem, but the economic structure of our news media business is under enormous pressure. As anyone who takes the paper knows, it's much smaller, much less thorough than it once was. We are trying to transition to a digital world, but that transition is very difficult, very spotty, at least for local newspapers. And so the role that we have played in sort of fostering the marketplace of ideas or providing a public square in which a marketplace of ideas could operate is under enormous financial pressure. I've said this before, and I really believe it. I love what I do, but I can't do it for free. You know, I need a home and, you know, like everyone else. And so it is a fact that at some point our community and all communities will have to decide where's the best place to create a gathering space for the marketplace of ideas that the newspaper has typically been. It may be the Star. I hope it is the Star. I'm nearing the end of my career in Kansas City. I've been, as I say, a reporter for more than 40 years now, and so that my time is coming to an end. But younger people will have to decide where do we exchange facts? Where do we talk about ideas and interesting concepts and concerns in a community? And it may be the Star, I hope it is, but if it isn't, it will need to be somewhere, because no community can continue without this sort of common base of knowledge and understanding. And in fact, one of the reasons our politics is so disjointed now is that we are losing that common ground and relying instead largely on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and other places in which prejudices and mistruths can be easily promulgated and you can avoid being exposed to alternative views or alternative ways of looking at the world. Now, I'm a First Amendment guy. I've lived my whole life. If there's one animating principle, actually two in everything I've done, one, protect the First Amendment, and two, be transparent. I've said to politicians repeatedly, I don't care if you don't like, you know, what I like, but just be honest about it and we'll be fine. Don't try to obfuscate. Kevin Yoder in the debate, he came to the editorial board. He said, you know, I never wanted Barack Obama to fail. I was willing. I mean, that was just really an affront to the truth. I said, just own it, Kevin. Just own it. It's fine if you didn't like the president. Just say so. So those have been animating principles for me throughout my career. And the First Amendment is sacred to me. And so the idea that we would limit discussions on Twitter or regulate what you can say on Facebook, I find troubling to say the least. The answer isn't regulating speech. It's more speech, more discussion, more facts, and for communities to support organizations and news organs that hold truth and facts in the highest esteem and as a first goal. And I can say honestly to you, we have shrunk at the Star. There were once 100 reporters where 25 now sit. But we've lost three-fourths of our reporting staff since I started at the paper in 2005. But each day, my colleagues come to the newspaper with the idea of finding the best version of the truth they can and providing it to the community. And the community absolutely has to have that if democracy is going to work as effectively as it should. And so there will have to be some model, some way to provide that, and it will cost money. It won't be free. I worked in TV for many years, and of course the idea that you get TV for free is a bit of a misnomer. How many take cable? I mean, you know, so, but you don't subscribe to your local broadcast, and one of the reasons television stations struggle with community issues reporting them at times is because of that fact that they only have 10 or 15 reporters who can go to murders and fires and other things because it's easier and it's cheaper. So at some point, everyone in this community and other communities, in my view, will have to show that they value deep reporting and deep journalism. And we hope it's the Star. If it isn't, it certainly should be some other organization. You will have to demand facts and truth, which is another way to say, and I was a fellow down at the Dole Institute in 2014, and I did a series of lectures about the media and the 2014 midterm elections. And one of the things we talked a lot about is how citizens, in essence, have to become journalists on their own. You now have to be editors. You have to be skeptical of things you're told and things you read and things you hear and see. You have to challenge your neighbors and friends and congregants when they tell you things they believe or have seen. Conversations, sensible, civilized conversations among all of us are much more important than they would have been, say, 20, 25 years ago, when you could rely on mainstream media to provide that type of discussion. You know, figuring out what is truth and what isn't truth is very hard to do. It's not hard when you do, you know, is the unemployment rate 3.7% or isn't it? There are places to go to get that. But some of our political questions are pretty complicated. Was the Power and Light District downtown, was that a good idea or not a good idea? There might be, we can tell you the facts of what it cost, what it does, what it has done, but ultimately the truth of that discussion will be based on your own views of how you interpret those facts. Do we spend enough on schools or not? You know, finding the true answer to that question is extraordinarily difficult. I can tell you what we spend. I can tell you how it's spent. But is it enough? Is it enough? That's a very, very hard, broad question to get at. And so some facts are always subject to challenge. I get yelled at all the time when we write about school finance in Kansas because conservatives think we spend far more than we've ever spent before, and it's sort of apples to oranges, and we get into disputes over those facts. Sometimes they're difficult to work out. But I believe firmly that there's an objective place we can reach where we have a common basis of truth and facts from which to make political decisions. So that's why Tuesday's election, my friends, is so important, because it will send a signal as to whether truth still matters, whether facts still matter, or whether the country will embrace and endorse an approach which says that truth is obsolete or anachronistic or old-fashioned and unnecessary in our current politics. So I appreciate the chance to visit with you here today. As I say, my time as a reporter is nearing its end one way or another. I love what I do. I'm going to do it until they, as they say, pry the pen out of my fingers. But that may happen soon. I don't know. It's certainly conceivable that this election and maybe the one in 2020 would be the last that I would cover. I began my career in 1977 covering politics, and in that time, I have believed just with about every bone in my body that the public needs facts and truth to make decisions. And I've worked my best to try and do that. I haven't always succeeded. I've made mistakes, lots of them. It's amazing how many times you can write something that's just wrong. And yet I've always endeavored to correct the record, and I've always printed or published something that I believe to be true. I've never knowingly misled the audience or my readers or viewers. The president cannot make those statements. He has misled you. And he does it as a political approach. And that approach, I would argue, threatens our ability to reach democratic solutions. It doesn't mean I oppose conservatives or against conservatives or liberals or moderates. It's that we cannot make decisions unless we agree on where the sun rises and where it sets. And if we dispute that, the rest of it becomes extraordinarily difficult. So again, thank you so much for your for the chance to come here today. I hope I haven't bored you too much. I love getting out to groups like this. I will say, before we take questions, you know, I speak to a lot of groups, some groups like your own, and it's always preaching to the choir in a way. I mean, you know, the people in these audiences are smart, pay attention, they make great decisions. Sometimes I've been to Trump rallies where it's a different crowd, I'll just say that. And although I don't want to dismiss their good faith belief in the president or their votes. I mean, everybody's free to vote as they want to do. But you know, sometimes the excuse that we know that it's a lie and we don't care is pretty frustrating. It's not the lie itself that's the problem. It's the idea that you can tell untruths. So, again, my pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for listening attentively. And raise your hands and come on forward and go ahead.
Well, that was good, was it? Would the ushers come forward and take up the collection for the church? And please remember our rules about statements or questions. We prefer questions and statements in the form of questions.
It seems to me that
double jeopardy a little bit. Yes.
People are really getting excited now about the possible great amount of turnout in this next election. And they're predicting things like maybe 50%. So my question to you is, if we're supposed to get excited about 50%, then what institutions have failed us in motivating individuals and teaching civics so that the other 50% who aren't voting aren't voting?
Yeah. Well, thanks for the question. I would just caution you a little bit. That 50% number, which I think roughly is what people are looking at, is 50% of eligible voters, but it may be closer to 70% of registered voters. Our problem is registration as opposed to just people who are eligible to vote, and about half of the country does not believe it's valuable to take the time to register and then cast ballots, and it does take some investment to do that. Some places are making it easier to register, easier to cast ballots. My guess is, you know, long after I'm gone, the idea of voting in a place will be seen as a complete anachronism. We'll do it online or by phone or some other places, and that will increase turnout. Some states have gone to mail-in ballots, and their turnout is 75-80%. So I think convenience is part of it. Having said that, I read a thing today that says or said that not voting is voting. If you don't cast ballots, you are making a statement too. And in some ways, you're making a statement that for whatever reason, you find government, politics, community irrelevant to the way you live your life, that you have other challenges that you don't think the political structure is equipped to handle. And there is some truth to that. You know, the national government particularly is locked in stalemate, has been for some time, and it's hard for people to look at that and say, well, if I vote this time, it'll make a difference. Remember, just as a straight mathematical fact, any individual vote is probably won't make a difference in any race. It's only the cumulative votes that make a difference. But it's very rare to have a vote have a race decided by one vote. And economists will tell you that devalues it for some people because they're going, what difference does my vote make? It's going to be what it's going to be. So that's part of the answer. Make it more convenient, make it easier, and make government seem more relevant to the way people live their lives. But the other answer is, again, the newspaper. You know, it's a community in which ideas are freely exchanged, and it's part of our what we are, not something we do every 2 years or, you know, every 6 months sometimes in Kansas City. It's what, you know, we're going to elect a mayor next year. Well, we need to be talking about that now. You know, what is it we want the mayor to do? What is it, what challenges does Kansas City face? And to the extent that we can make government and community a part of our everyday conversation and lives, I think interest in voting goes up, and then you make it easier and we'll have more turnout. So I hope that answered your question. Yes, ma'am.
Two short queries and one request. One, is there a chance that we could get rid of gerrymandering and get a more democratic process for districting? Two, is there a chance that we might get rid of the Electoral College? And what are your thoughts on
from
that?
From your lips to my heart. I have written that over and over and over.
And a request, please don't retire in my lifetime.
Well, now I'm blushing. Let me take that in kind of inverted order. The Electoral College is the silliest. I can't tell you how. I wrote a paper about the Electoral College when I was in junior high school. And I remember thinking at the time, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You could become president with 25% of the vote. I mean, the Electoral College does nothing that it says it will do. It doesn't protect small states. The only thing it protects is competitive states, which Missouri used to be but is not anymore. And so all the attention goes to Ohio or Pennsylvania or Wyoming that are competitive, Florida. It really, I must say, you know, like much of the Constitution, and this is a controversial thing, like much of the Constitution, it was a compromise designed to protect Southern interests and particularly slavery. And the Electoral College was another way to guarantee that the president would reflect the views of Southern states. It's an anachronism, it's foolishness, and it's the only race in the world where you can be elected with fewer votes than your opponent. I mean, that's just the logic of it is just escapes me. And I've written it. People yell at me when I write it, but I believe that strongly. Gerrymandering is much tougher, because there's an infinite number of ways you can draw districts in a representative system. And gerrymandering for Edmund Gerry was a fact of our politics 200 years ago. As you know, the Clean Missouri measure is on the ballot. We've recommended at the Star a yes vote on that amendment because it changes gerrymandering to a certain degree. And as I told somebody the other day, Republicans are against it because they don't want the Democrats to gerrymander. They want to keep their own gerrymander. there are ways to get closer to fair districts. And there is, again, some of this sorting going on where more liberal voices come to urban areas, more conservative voices go to rural areas. All I can suggest is that we're just vigilant about that and try to get to the place where the districts seem the most fair. And let me just finish by saying the way districts are drawn are much more important than people know. And I'll give you an example. In Kansas City, council districts have traditionally been drawn north to south, which in essence exacerbates the racial divide, because you in essence isolate racial communities by drawing north and south. The exception is the 6th district, which goes from state line across, and that the 6th district is the most racially diverse, the most energetic in some ways. I mean, the 6th district is what Kansas City could be if we just drew our districts this way instead of this way, which, by the way, will be an issue in 2 years when the new census comes in. So drawing districts is not, Kraske and I talk all the time, oh, God, eyes roll, we're doing a redistricting story. It's, in some ways, the whole ballgame of how we organize our community. It's extraordinarily important that we pay attention to that issue. And then I'm not going to retire until I'm ready to retire, I am closer to the end of my career than to the beginning. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I'm a faithful subscriber to the Kansas City Star.
Thank you. And I apologize if you're going to say I don't get delivery on time.
I have wonderful delivery.
Great.
It's always there when I open the door to look for it.
That's what we like to hear.
Yes. But I did, I remember the years when Yale was on the staff, and the paper to me did seem to devote a lot of space to left issues, leftist views. Mm-hmm. Then I saw the Star veer to the right, and I was alarmed, like a lot of people in this room, that it seemed to be veering more to the right than we thought was healthy. Now, I have recently observed a lot of investigative articles, and they're wonderful.
Yeah,
they are really wonderful.
Yeah,
so I'm wondering, will the investigative reporting continue for the near future? And how does it happen that you get such good investigative reporting from Jeff City, for instance, the recent Holly circumstances?
Thanks for the question. Some people in this room may know this. Yale, Alba Hawke and I were classmates in high school. We went to high school together and have been friends for 40 years. And he's, as you may know, with the Peace Corps now in Africa, and just amazing guy and smart guy. And I don't want to bore this audience with walking through what happened when he left and then the editorial board. We are left of center. We are trying, and the editorial board, we are trying very hard to make sure that in our op-ed pages that we are as open to conservative voices as liberal ones. But in our editorial positions, we are typically left of center, with an understanding that we'll certainly listen and consider alternative viewpoints. We've tried to get every candidate in, a Republican candidate, and as you may see in your paper today, they all declined to do so. Chris Kobach wouldn't come in. Josh Hawley wouldn't come in. The only Republican who came to visit with us was Kevin Yoder. And as a result, our discussion of his race took about 2 hours to work through, because we were trying very hard to make sure we were fair in that endorsement. Then you asked about the quality of our investigative reporting. We have astonishingly good reporters now. Jason Hancock down in Jeff City, Steve Bachrod is brilliant, Judy Thomas, Laura Bauer have been working so hard. Joe Robertson, I mean, I'm going to leave somebody out, although with only 25 reporters, I can pretty much name everybody. Eric Adler, Mike Hendricks, just go down the list. And I will say this, the danger of repeating myself, your newspaper still every day tries to do the best job it can. And people ask me all the time, do you miss television? And the answer is no, although it was, to be clear, much more lucrative than being a newspaper reporter. But I go into a newsroom every day where the goal is still the best comprehensive report we can put together with our resources. Television stations want accurate news. They expect it. They want great journalism, but it isn't the first goal. The first goal is physical attractiveness, dynamism, energy. That's what they want. That's the baseline. And then if you get good journalism after that, that's all the better. In the newspaper business, as I prove, looks aren't everything. I'm proud to be with Lindsay Wise in Washington and Brian Lowry and all the people who work so hard, Murray Williams. I'm just going around the room in my head now. Andy Marceau, Andy does health reporting for us. Does anybody know Andy in this room? Andy's a younger reporter. He suffered an attack of meningitis in school at the University of Kansas and lost both of his hands. And so he is a reporter with basically, you know, writing on a typewriter with two thumbs. And yet he's one of the most brilliant journalists I've ever been around, Andy. So I'm humbled, frankly, to be with these folks every day. And then my colleagues, of course, on the editorial board. We are still trying to do the best we can, and we're going to try to do that until somebody says we just can't do it anymore.
Good morning to you.
Thank you.
Unlike the previous speaker, I can't flatter you by saying I subscribe to the Kansas City Star. But as you probably gather from my accent, that's because I come from 6,000 miles away and I'm a visitor to Kansas City. I come from a little town in England called Lewes in Sussex, where in fact one of your founding fathers came from, Thomas Paine, who was persuaded to come over by Benjamin Franklin, partly to take part in the revolution, but also because Thomas Paine got his landlady's daughter pregnant.
Yes.
And had to leave in rather a hurry.
Yeah, Thomas was a sketchy figure in many ways.
He, of course, wrote the Rights of Man, on which your country is founded. And there is a feeling amongst quite a few Europeans that America's lost its way in terms of its roots in democracy. And you mentioned earlier that a no vote was in fact a vote. And I would suggest that maybe you would like to answer the question, should it not be time for compulsory voting to be introduced in America so that everybody gets their voice heard? And whether it's one side of the political party or the other, it doesn't make any difference. The point is the people have spoken. And I'm sure Thomas Paine would agree with that.
Right. And I'm not sure he'd support compulsory voting, but because it certainly didn't exist in his time. But he's a fascinating figure, I must say.
I talk to a lot of people, and I've been talking to young people, and I get this reply, oh, I'm not much interested in politics. How do we get them to know that it's not politics, it's being a citizen?
Correct. I thank you for the question, and I agree completely, as you might have guessed from my remarks. I do think that young people are increasingly connected to their communities in ways that I might not have anticipated even 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, I think the election of Donald Trump, good or bad, really did galvanize some younger people to say, look, I can't put this on autopilot. You know, I have to pay attention. That's why, by the way, people ask me after the Kansas City bond issue passed so overwhelmingly and the East Side sales tax passed, and people were asking me, well, how did that happen? You know, even north of the river, they were pro-tax. And my argument is Donald Trump has taught people that you can't just assume things are going to happen the way you want them to. You have to get involved. And again, as I suggested, not just at the ballot box, but in your communities. And so I do think younger people and the turnout for this election, based on early voting trends, seems to bear that out in 7 or 8 different states. I think I saw a figure the other day, the turnout of 18 to 29-year-olds is up like 250%, more than doubled and doubled again. So, but again, I just make the point that voting is not the end of it, it's the beginning. It's the beginning. And I do think, and one of the reasons, just to tie this into my discussion about the paper, I believe that young people will figure out information and figure out ways to get facts that maybe I can't, you know, even anticipate now. I mean, let's face it, in this room, whoever thought that you could get your paper on your phone, you know, or that you would even have a phone? You know, I mean, the changes, technological changes in my lifetime and yours are just breathtaking. That's why, by the way, climate change needs to be an issue in our communities in a way it hasn't been before. There are all kinds of things. Yes, ma'am.
Something I want to know is, what do you think the effect of the of Trump's tariffs on the voting habits of Midwest farmers is going to be?
One of the first editorials I ever wrote at the Star was on tariffs. I wrote it in about 3 weeks after I started on the editorial board because it was clear that's the way the president was headed, and it was not clear to the people in Missouri and Kansas what that would mean for them. But I'm trying to figure out how to say this effectively. Economic issues in contemporary politics are less important than cultural issues, and that's increasingly true as you move up the ballot. I mean, it's less true when you're running for the city council, then taxes do matter. As you get farther up and up and up, people make decisions based on a tribal cultural thing rather than a specific issue. And that's not true, obviously, for everybody. But so there's a story in today's New York Times talking to farmers about the tariffs, and you will hear repeatedly. In fact, I think it's the front page of our paper today too, out of McClatchy. You will see several references to the idea that farmers, in essence, say, "I know it hurts us, but I still believe in the president," and that's because of this cultural approach. And just to be fair, distrust of Democrats. I mean, there's just a distrust and dislike them. So I have no doubt that if it was a straight economic decision that the president would, you know, struggle a little bit more. But one more question, and then George is going to give me the big hook, which I deserve at this point.
I hate to admit it, but I kind of like following political ads just from an analytical perspective. And usually the Republican ad makes me want to support the Democrat even
right,
more.
Right, right. I know that it works.
But I've noticed that the campaign ads are usually fairly civilized, but the third-party ads are just really getting outrageous.
Right. And of course, that's because the candidates don't want to be directly attached to an attack on an opponent. And so you give it to the – now – for those who haven't been paying attention, the Missouri Senate race, all spending, easily over $100 million this year.
Yeah.
There's already been $70 million spent from outside groups, about 20 from Claire McCaskill, about 10 maybe from Josh Hawley. So easily over $100 million, and 75% of it is the stuff you're talking about with the mobs and all the other
things. But I'm wondering, is there any hope or talk about a professional ethics organization to try and rein in this at all? Or are the networks doing anything to have any kind of vetting? Like the Sharice David ads were just really offensive.
Do you know who a guy named Corey Bliss runs I assume you're talking about the Congressional Leadership Fund.
Yeah.
A guy named Corey Bliss runs that. Corey Bliss was the guy who came in and saved Pat Roberts in Kansas in 2014 when Greg Orman was making so I know Corey a little bit. But there is unlikely to be any systemic attempt to contain messages in political ads, and I'm not really in favor of that either. I'm a First Amendment guy. I just believe in the inherent intelligence and good faith of most voters, and I don't do Truth Watch anymore in part because it's enormously time-consuming. It just is when you have that many ads. And second, when I started it, ads would make one claim, you know, my opponent voted for a tax increase. Now, my opponent voted for 47 different tax increases, and I got to go look at all 47 to see if that's true or not, and it's just not possible. It's very much like the mailers that you get. I tell people all the time, you know, if your fireplace needs, you know, kindling, these brochures, just toss them. They're just the most... There's no valuable information in those mailers. And one of the impacts of Truth Watch and other groups is people have now begun to discount what they see on TV and just assume it's not. But here's what you need to worry about. It's not the television ad, which is bad enough. It's online ads that no one can take a look at. And one of the things that's coming, again, for our kids and their kids, are ads that are micro-targeted based on your digital profile so that they can send me an ad, "Hey, Dave, I know you don't like guns because you've been visiting Macy's website," or whatever, and then targeting an ad that says to me, I'm for gun control, and then to my neighbor, the exact opposite, based on his or her profile. And there's no way to catch that. None. How could any reporter or any person, unless you're leaning over the back fence, hey, you know, what's John Jones telling you? Well, you know, whatever. So that's why each person now must become in some ways a journalist by doing homework, by paying attention, by talking about these things. Again, citizenship is not a pastime. It's what we are. It's who we are. This room understands it because they've listened to me yak for an hour, which, you know, deserves some counseling too, probably. But for the vast, the technology is changing, the messages are changing. It just demands that we ask for truth. And if there's any other message I would hope everyone would take away, it's that today. So with that, I thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Truth or Consequences, Thoughts of the Midterm Elections with Dave Helling. This program was recorded on Sunday, November 4th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.